Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kevin Bennett. And today we're having a special episode devoted to COVID-19 and the impact on rural South Carolina. Our guests today in the virtual studio are Michelle Stanek, the Associate Director for the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare, and Megan Weiss, a new employee with the center. She is our Director of Engagement. Welcome, Michelle and Megan. So what we're going to kind of talk about today is some of the highlights of what we're seeing across rural South Carolina, and talk a little bit nationally as well as far as the impact is concerned with not only the outbreak, but the impact on rural healthcare systems, economies, and the people that live there. So it's going to range a little bit widely, but it'll be more conversational in nature, and a little bit of data, a little bit of anecdote, and just trying to get a good sense and get the message out there about rural folks in South Carolina. So to begin with, I think it's important to note that this disease does actually exist in rural South Carolina. I think there's some, misperceptions out there that since there aren't as many people, they're not as densely packed as far as housing goes, that the spread will be lower and or it doesn't affect them as much. But we're seeing that's just not quite the case. I know nationally, I think every rural county now has a confirmed COVID case. I'm sure that's the true for South Carolina as well. But there's a lot of reasons why we think that rural could be harder hit in some ways. You know, there's a lot of things that are different among rural populations, especially in South Carolina, that could cause that perfect storm of having a bad outcome. For example, rural folks tend to be older, which, as we know, rural older folks are more likely to get ill from this disease and or die from the disease. There are fewer healthcare resources in rural areas, hospitals, providers, those kinds of things. Insurance rates are lower. So even if there is a doctor or a hospital, if you don't have insurance, you're less likely to go to the doctor to seek care for it. And employment is different. It's just harder to work from home if you work in tourism or if you're food industry or other kind of service industry that tends to be more prominent in rural areas. So given all that, we wanted to just kind of dive into that a little bit and give you some perspective on what we're seeing, and just try to make sure that everybody understands what's going on. So Michelle, I want to bat it over to you. And if you could just tell me what you have seen and heard from rural providers around the state, especially on their experience on the ground and trying to deal with this.
Sure, Kevin, thanks. And I'd add one other that will disproportionately have the impact of COVID-19 impact rural communities, and that's the disease burden that many of our South Carolina rural communities. They have higher rates of chronic diseases that we have seen not only in South Carolina, but nationally have lead to poorer outcomes. And most of the folks in South Carolina who have died due to COVID-19 have been either elderly and or have chronic illnesses that make them more susceptible to negative outcomes for the disease. So I just wanted to add that in as well. And then with regards to what we're hearing from the rural provider community, it's a really difficult time from them on from many perspectives of taking care of their patients, either with or suspected COVID-19 patients, but then also making sure that they're able to continue to serve their community as well. And so not only are they having to deal with the impact of the pandemic, but also they're really struggling financially as they have seen precipitous drop in the number of patients coming in for routine or preventive care. And so that provides a real stress from a financial standpoint on the healthcare system, but then also concerns about their patients getting needed care for their diabetes, their hypertension, getting a mammogram, if they're, you know, if there's a suspicion of maybe breast cancer. So they're really sort of juggling lots of different balls, preparing and taking care of patients with COVID-19, trying to make sure that their patients are getting those needed chronic illness care that they need at the same time of sort of juggling that really big ball of financial instability that they find themselves into due to cancellation of elective procedures if it's a hospital, or just a huge drop in the number of patients that are coming in. Many of the practices that we work with have seen up to 50 to 80% of decreased volume. So that's fewer patients coming to their practice, which again leads to the financial difficulties that they're facing.
So it's kind of an ironic situation where we're gearing up for this anticipated surge in demand, at least at the hospital level, which leads to a precipitous decline in demand at the primary care level, right?
Correct. Yeah. So because they're really preparing for the surge that we all know will probably come a little bit later in rural communities, and patients just are delaying or not really are pushing off routine care, whether it be well child visits or sort of that routine care, the quarterly diabetes visit, they're pushing it off. So it is sort of a ironic position that these practices find themselves in.
Have you heard from any of these providers, especially the ambulatory clinics and physicians' offices, about layoffs or furloughs or even closures?
Yeah, so I have not heard of any practices, rural health clinics that have closed, but definitely a large percentage of them have furloughed or significantly curtailed hours and staff and layoffs. But I know that the closures are just around the corner. I've heard from several practices that are concerned that that through the end of April perhaps, but if things don't improve as they get into May, they're worried about really sort of making it through a long downturn in volume. So recently had a conversation about two practices that are really going to have to make some tough decisions in a very short order. And this could be largely because they always were sort of had financial stressors being in a rural community, as you already mentioned, about lower insurance rates. And so they were sort of on the edge financially to begin with, and this is just going to, make it more difficult.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I know that some policies around telehealth and telemedicine have been relaxed to try to not only get better care for folks, but to try to stave off some of these financial losses.
Yeah, I think that's really, I think not only on the federal level, but the state level, there's been a lot of movement and changes to loosen these regulations and requirements to really promote telehealth and allow for practices or clinics to be able to deliver needed care via tele. So the patient doesn't have to come into the bricks and mortar practice. That can be, those opportunities have been great. And we know of practices that have been very successful. I know of some practices that have been able to convert most, if not all, of their visits to televisits. And so they haven't seen sort of the real precipitous drop in volume of visits each day. That's much more challenging in rural communities for lots of different reasons, beginning with broadband access and really sort of the IT infrastructure to support televisits or telehealth or virtual care. So that really has put rural healthcare providers at sort of not being able to be as nimble and really sort of make that transition as fast. And even at this point, even though federal policy has been changed, the reimbursement sort of criteria and how to actually get paid for that is not clear. And so many rural providers are reluctant to provide telehealth visits when payment will be delayed, perhaps a month, 6 weeks, we're not sure. So that's been a real challenge to them. Over and above the broadband issues, the capacity around having a platform to support this this work, and just the systems in place to be able to convert really rapidly from a face-to-face visit model to a telehealth virtual care model.
Right, because that's not an easy switch, because providers have to have broadband themselves, which even in South Carolina, there are practices who don't have broadband connections. And, you know, the patients themselves have to either have broadband or have a smartphone that connects to the data, or live in an area that actually can connect data. So there's a host of other challenges associated with that I think that people lose sight of when we're talking about these technologies.
Yeah, and I think that we in this country have really been moving pretty rapidly to expanding virtual health. And I think that has predominantly been that acceleration has been happening in metropolitan areas or with big systems, not so much in rural communities. And so those systems are at an advantage because they had already started developing the capacity and the workflows and the IT infrastructure to support that, where that hadn't happened in rural. So making this sort of switch more difficult. I will say that many rural providers are providing care via telephone. And so a lot of them are doing that just because they want to continue taking care of their patients. But the reimbursement for that telephone care is pretty significantly less than the face-to-face visit reimbursement and or the televisit reimbursement.
So that, and those are obviously all big problems. And, you know, I think folks have heard, hopefully, a good deal about hospital closures being higher in rural, accelerating in rural. I think we certainly anticipate that to get a lot worse before it gets better, especially due to this, because there's a lot of small rural hospitals that are going to be at a higher risk of closure, if not outright closed. I think a couple in West Virginia have already closed because of this. You know, that's something that is possible to happen in South Carolina.
I think nationally, I saw something that said about 450 rural hospitals nationally were vulnerable even before COVID-19. And so again, similar to the ambulatory or the rural health practice, they have seen a significant decrease in volume, eliminated all or most elective procedures. And so things that have been able to financially support the hospital have been really either intentionally shut down to make sure that they have room and capacity to serve COVID-19 patients when the surge comes, and or just folks have canceled them on their own because they really sort of stay at home parameters that we have in South Carolina.
Exactly. One thing I think that is important to note too is that it seems to be that, you know, some back of the envelope research that's been done by a colleague of mine in the School of Public Health, that the tests for this COVID-19, we don't have nearly as many tests as we would like. Not nearly enough people have gotten tests, and it seems to be pretty directly correlated between having a hospital in the community and getting a test. So a lot of rural places don't have a hospital. It might be in their county. If it's not, it's not close, because it's in the central part or in a population center. So there's a lot of folks in the state that are 30 to 60 minutes away from a hospital. So the testing is just not very high. So when we look at some of the stats, it doesn't look like rural places are being particularly hard hit. Have you heard any of the local providers talking about handling cases without them being, I guess, confirmed, or how are they dealing with that?
So I think to start with testing, from what I hear, and I think we'll have some more definitive information soon, but a lot of rural practices are not testing. They're either not testing because they don't feel like they have the capacity to sort of transition that patient once they have they have an acute phase of the illness. So what happens then in their community? But more commonly, they either don't having testing supplies and or they don't have personal protective equipment that is sufficient to allow them to feel comfortable to test within their community. And now that's not universal, but there are many rural communities where rural providers feel like they don't have the PPE and or they don't even feel they don't have the testing equipment or the testing supplies to be able to test. So I think that that's exactly right, what you were commenting on, that less testing happening for residents in rural communities. And so when the patient has tested positive, I know that there are rural providers who are providing support for those patients at their pay as they're taking care of their patients as the patient's medical home, and providing that either through inpatient in office visits and or through telehealth or telephonically. Most of practices in South Carolina and rural areas have implemented procedures for patients who call them with questions. So if they have suspected COVID-19, they've implemented procedures of how to see and take care of that patient in their practice, whether it be having the patient wait in the car until they're ready to see them and getting a phone call and then taking the patient in through a specific door, through to specific exam rooms, so that the patient is taken care of, but then the staff and the other patients in the practice aren't exposed to possible infection. So I think there's been a lot of work, particularly in the first couple weeks, where practices had to rapidly change their workflows to move to telephone screening, think through how they're going to do sort of not a traditional waiting room, and then how to get the patient in and out to minimize exposure to either the staff and or other patients that they're taking care of. So that's been going on, and there's been sharing of best practices about how to do that. And I think that really took up a lot of their focus for the first couple weeks. And now they're really thinking about how do we make sure those patients with diabetes, heart disease, COPD, how are they continuing to get care in a way that protects them but allows them to be seen.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that's definitely something to keep an eye on as we go forward. Want to pivot a little bit here. Before we got on this, we were talking about the cases that we've seen in the state and across the country, and there being a larger proportion of non-white, particularly African American populations that are being affected by this. I know, Megan, you were mentioning some of the specific stats about that. Can you tell us what you saw and what you're seeing in that regard?
Sure. So from the data we saw yesterday, for those listening, that would be April 14th, if you're keeping track of the data. For South Carolina, our population of African Americans is about 27%. However, for the COVID-19 cases where race data is collected, 41% of those cases are among African Americans, and it's also 56% of the related deaths. So we're definitely seeing a racial inequity in terms of the cases that are being tested and we're able to collect, and those deaths. And to some degree, there's still some conversation about why, but I think there's consensus around the fact that because of our state, as we were talking earlier in this podcast, the higher rates of chronic disease, you know, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, some of those other risk factors are found also among our African-American population, that is contributing to the disproportionate impact that we're seeing.
Right. So we're getting kind of back to that dual disparity that we've seen in other studies of if you're non-white and rural, you tend to be hit a little bit harder, right?
Exactly. So it even goes back, you know, to the social determinants of health, you know, the access to the regular care, access to the preventive care, and then that's just compounded when we have a new virus come in this pandemic.
So, you know, thinking about just that, I mean, is there anything that community groups, providers that they can do to I don't know, how do we improve that? How do we get better data? How do we get better testing? How do we get better treatment for these doubly hit populations?
Well, in my opinion, I think there's quite a few things we can do. Obviously, at least to me, increasing our testing as we are able to. We were just talking about how there could be under testing in rural areas for a variety of reasons. But also something else we've been talking about is just the communication about what is going on in a way that can get to the communities affected. You know, in terms of washing hands, having the social distance, being able to say, okay, you know, we have a birthday or something is going on, but right now we can't all get together in this, and this is why. Those of us, you know, that we've been following this, you know, we're watching some of the press conferences, we're reading the daily papers with the daily numbers that are coming out. I'm thinking about it a lot, but not everybody is or is able to. So having the clear, consistent messaging around washing hands, around keeping a social distance, not going out if you don't have to, you know, following the guidance with the masks if you need to, but having that and having also the social support and of the neighbors in that, and being able to get out there and share the messages in ways that it would be received, and also have the people delivering the message be those who are the trusted people in the community.
Yeah, I think sometimes you see, you know, the nightly or early in the morning, the number of cases broken down by county or zip code. And I think sometimes when in a rural county, if they see those numbers as, you know, the single digits, they there may be the perception that, oh wow, it's not a problem in our county. And recently we now have data available that shows these are the ones that have been diagnosed, but these are sort of how much we think it's penetrated the community. And I think focusing on that number would help people understand that even though the testing hasn't happened and though they're not really shown in that one column, that really COVID-19 is in every rural county and every rural community. And so it really would sort of give more sort of oomph to the stay at home, limit your contact, wash your hands, those preventive measures that have been publicized.
Yeah. I agree completely. And I also think that in some ways, because, you know, it is evolving and we're learning something new all the time, that some of the initial information was, well, it really hits older people hard, which we know, and definitely worried about our seniors. But that it's just like the flu or the cold, as if it doesn't really matter if you're younger, you'll be okay. And that's not necessarily true, both in terms of some of the other deaths we're seeing, but also really emphasizing that even if you yourself, you know, you may have it, you may be a carrier of it and not know you have it because it is in the community. So it's as much caring about your grandmother or your aunt or your neighbor. It's it's that community responsibility that I do think that you see sometimes. You see those tight community ties in rural areas and being able to capitalize on that this is how we protect our community and protect everyone in our community, being able to capitalize on that as a strength in terms of, you know, as we're staying apart, but we're staying apart because we're protecting everyone, because we care about everyone where we live.
I think it used that community cohesiveness to the advantage versus the disadvantage. I think in some really hot, rural hotspots, we know that that exposure and the transmission rate have really accelerated due to a community event or or an event related to a trusted community member. So really, but use flipping it on its head and saying, you know, at this point, use those tight-knit communities to really look out for each other by staying home or taking the precautions that have been recommended.
Yeah, I think all of that is, those are very valid points. And I've seen a lot of, I guess, writings and opinions and things like that, especially nationally, about rural being, is it better off or is it worse off? Is it better off because they can socially isolate more quickly because they're not as dense? Or are they worse off because they can't socially isolate because there's only one grocery store? There's only one, you know, there's five policemen and they mingle, you know. And I don't know that we have a great answer for that, but hopefully we'll see that cohesiveness win out and they will be protected. So if we were to, I don't know, looking forward a little bit here, you know, what can we do once we start emerging from this? Hopefully we'll hit the peak soon and things will start opening back up. What are some of the things that we could do as a state, as local communities, as healthcare systems to try to rebuild our rural communities, rebuild our rural healthcare systems, and make sure they're not as vulnerable, if not stronger, going forward?
Yeah, I think looking at the opportunities and really sort of having this COVID-19 pandemic sort of have a new opportunity to discuss changes that have to happen to the healthcare delivery system or the community as a whole to really support and foster health, I think is something that we can turn this sort of very challenging time into a positive. So I think one of the things that we all have discussed a lot is that obviously expanding and ensuring broadband access and IT infrastructure to rural communities is critical. We all knew that before COVID-19. It is front and center essential as we think about protecting the public health, also delivering care. So I would hope that after this, that there is stronger support and impetus to really ensure that all rural communities have access to good to broadband, and that we can also support rural communities into developing the systems and capacity for virtual care or telehealth, and that we really look and think about how care can be delivered in a way that is consumer focused and also make sure that patients are engaged with a wide range of the workforce. So really tackle those chronic illness burden in rural communities that make them so vulnerable. And so looking at what kind of workforce we need to make that happen, whether it be healthcare extenders, community health workers, a more robust public health navigators within communities. So those are just two things that I see as sort of the ways forward to making sure that the healthcare delivery system and the health of our rural communities is improved as we come out of this.
And I think the telehealth, telemedicine piece might be a really interesting one. I know it's a little bit difficult with prior to this, the way the regulations and reimbursements were set up, it wasn't as, I guess, financially friendly to rural and smaller providers as it could be. I think this might actually provide a model for how it can be delivered in a very user-friendly way, patient-friendly way, patient-centered way, and in a way that actually not only provides great care, but is financially viable. So I think that could be an opportunity that comes out of this.
Yeah, I think that was one of the limitations that we had been sort of up against in before the changes, at least the temporary changes to regulations, is the payment models did not support care that wasn't face-to-face. And now that we have at least a temporary reprieve, hopefully there can be a reconsideration that reimbursement for care, despite the delivery mechanism, whether it be a video visit or a telephonic visit, that good care doesn't require face-to-face all the time. So I think that that would be a huge step forward for rural providers to be able to really provide the care that their patients need and also tackle some of those longstanding problems we've always talked about in rural communities, transportation limitations, distance to provider, those kind of things. So,
yeah, and you also mentioned that, you know, attached to that, some different workforce options. I know that there will likely be a high unemployment rate for a while until some of this starts to recover. As we've seen prior to this, I've done some work around the Great Recession, so to speak, 2007 and 8, where rural unemployment took a lot longer to recover. But when we have these telemedicine and alternate model as a possibility of care, there's new opportunities that come up, like telehealth navigators, community navigators, other types of new workforce that didn't exist previously that could be supported by the local workforce.
Yeah, and even in the public health system, I've heard discussion nationally and speculation about as we reopen and recover, one of the keys to really sort of not having these cyclical openings and closings is to really have a robust public health workforce that can do contact tracings and really be in the communities and help sort of manage transmission and spread at the local level. So to me, that does not exist in South Carolina currently in a robust way. So how do we use local rural community providers to help build that needed, potentially necessary workforce as well?
Yeah, I think all of that is very, very true. What else do we see coming? You know, you talked about public health models. Megan, you have done a lot of work in public health and community health. Do you see opportunities here for community groups, community agencies, public agencies to start working together in a different way?
Absolutely. And in some communities, they already were. And I think that's provided a stronger basis for moving forward. I know that there are several groups currently, some community coalitions funded throughout the state in different areas that were really focused on chronic disease prevention and, you know, working on healthy living or active living and healthy eating. And I've heard recently that most of them have pivoted in the midst of this crisis to food security for their community. So they were able to take that community capacity, those connections they already had in terms of community members, nonprofit groups, businesses, state agencies together to bring those, to use the connections that have already been made in another way to address some of the immediate needs. And I think as we're seeing in other communities, people coming together out of the necessity of the crisis, hopefully those ties can be kept and to see how they can work together. Michelle, as you were talking about with contact tracing, I think that is a perfect opportunity for the community groups that are already working together, either formally or informally in a coalition, and with the employment aspect to take people in the community and of the community to both help with economic development, people getting jobs, but also who's more trusted, someone who already lives there to say, okay, this is where I've been, this is who I've been talking to, this is what's going on, and being able to take advantage of that. My hope is that the light that has been shined on public health because of this crisis reminds people that it's necessary and it's needed and there's a lot of work done. It's so difficult sometimes in our field because when we're doing everything right, no one really knows we're around. But that goal of keeping communities and populations healthy and the need for a robust workforce and investment in that, both for the data and the people on the ground and for the education and for prevention of outbreaks and other areas and to protect our environment too, is there. So one of the things I hope to see in moving forward is that renewed recognition of public health and the need for it, but then also that connection between the clinical aspects of what we're seeing the practices and moving to telehealth and moving in those other areas, but that those close community connections to that to bridge that gap. For example, pre-COVID, there have been FQHCs or other providers in different rural communities that also hosted farmers market for access to healthy food. So that's something that both addresses the chronic conditions and some of the chronic disease concerns of the patients, also brings in farmers local to the community, which increases the economic development and keeps money moving and in the community and builds that up, and also serves as a community meeting place. Now, we're going to need to wait till we can get together in groups again to do that type of work, but I think that the possibilities are there, and I think the answer would be different for how it looks in each community, because each community is very different. But the underlying perspective of the groups that have come together or who have already come together and are working even more closely with public health and with the providers to be able to not lose that. You know, sometimes when a crisis or something happens, you know, everyone comes together and then we get back to normal or what we think is normal and we forget those lessons we learned. I hope we can keep those aspects and continue to build on that moving forward.
Yeah, that sounds great. And with all of this, we really haven't even touched on the impact on the education system, on school kids of almost all ages, even up to even our medical school is impacted by this. And, you know, we don't know what this will impact on long range will be for outcomes. I think there's some uncertainty even around the food insecurity. I know a lot of schools have been delivering food. It's just kind of a big unknown, a natural experiment, so to speak. And that's a much larger topic, maybe for another day, but I think it's important to kind of bring that to the awareness as well.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize that the education system also had a lot of impact on the health of kids and their families, whether it be school-based clinics or the meals that that families and kids got through the schools, and really sort of that piece of it. So I think that impact needs to be looked at and sort of how we understand and the role of the education system in really promoting and supporting health in rural communities.
Yeah, and I think that, and there's a wide range of things that I think we need to, as an academic community, need to be aware of to research and investigate going forward out of this. Educational impact, we talked earlier about immunizations and preventive care. You know, I know they've heard concerns about children not getting their well child visits and their immunizations. You know, how do we track that? How do we keep up with that? How do we make up for that lost time?
Yeah, exactly. I've heard from some of my pediatrician friends that, you know, as people are not coming in for well visits due to, you know, very rational risk assessments and concerns, how do you catch back up? So she was already expressing a concern about a potential measles outbreak or of other childhood diseases, depending on how long this goes on and how do we reach out. And you know, Michelle touched on it earlier in terms of some of the drive-through clinics and some of the ways to mitigate that to keep people coming in, but also thinking about with chronic disease and management, you know, there's the immediate, how now that we have some of this set up, the immediate needs for chronic disease management, but what are the impacts on that moving forward going to be? So another area for our system to really be thinking forward about keeping an eye on and looking at what we can do.
Right, exactly. So with all that being said, there's a lot going on with this, that a lot of unknowns, a lot of uncertainty. I know we're doing our best to try to keep track of rural impacts, not just the healthcare system, but people and systems and economies. A lot of work to be done there. I will have to say, though, you probably have heard this a lot, but a huge shout out to our healthcare providers that are on the front lines and treating this disease. I know rural providers sometimes get maligned, but the quality of care that you can receive there is just as good, if not better, sometimes than in your urban centers. So Shout out to them, and shout out to those grocery workers and truck drivers and post office employees out there on the front lines as well, still keeping our country going the best they can. So I think that's all for today. We will put some links in our show notes to some articles about the impact on rural. We have a resource page for COVID response. I know we'll put a link to the DHEC page that's specific to COVID, as well as the State Office of Rural Health. They have a COVID response page as well. And anything else that we think is relevant, we'll throw in there so that you guys can click through there and read up more on this impact. So thanks to Megan and Michelle for joining me on this. And hope everyone out there is being safe. Keep your distance, wash your hands, wear the masks, and do the best you can to everybody else out there. And until next time.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.